Thank you, Gerald. So it's great to be finally here. So I'm going to tell you about this recent work that I've been doing together with Philip Glass, who's my student over there. So all the questions, please, you can ask them directly to Philip. Good. So I really like this Cheshire Cat analogy, so we kept it in the title. And perfect. So let me start. During these past weeks, we have seen many, many examples. I watched almost all the talks because the BA movie selections on the flight was not particularly amazing. So I watched almost all of the talks. And there were a lot of amazing results that they were relying on the key point, namely the asymptotic nature of the perturbative expansion. So the thing that I would like to discuss a little bit about is actually what happens. Question. So what if we have magic constellations between diagrams of the same order? So the idea that I have in mind is that, of course, we know bosonic fermionic diagrams might cancel, or might almost cancel. And what could happen is that in some cases, you can get, in some lucky cases, well, it depends on lucky from which point of view. From the point of view of resurgence, it's kind of unlucky, because you can get either finite radius of convergence, or even better, in some cases, you do get actually truncations. So you do get truncation. What I mean, you get finitely many perturbative coefficients. Finitely many perturbative coefficients. And the idea is that, well, maybe if you have bosonic and fermionic diagrams that can cancel, this is suggesting you that if you consider supersymmetric field theories, this is the general situation that might happen. But that's actually not necessarily true, so let me make a comment, like note. Supersymmetry is not a guarantee for convergence. So there were already various results in supersymmetric realization done by, well, none of the people are in the audience now, Inesh, Schiappa, and Jorge Russo, and also Masatomi Honda. So there were various results from supersymmetric realization that if you actually compute, I'm going to review later on what I mean with that, but if you compute for certain four-dimensional theories, so in 4D, you can take like n equal to 2 or this other n equal to 2 star, and then in 3D and in 5D, various other supersymmetric.
What means it's not a guarantee? Where you have a non-normalization symmetry, it is guaranteed. But
absolutely, yeah. So it depends on which observable you're considering.
Right, but in this way, you know, you have guarantee only in the case where guarantee is given.
Sure.
He's saying not just that it vanishes, it doesn't even converge. It's not a guarantee of convergence.
Non-normalization theorem, it means that it's guaranteed because it means that there is no
absolutely
answer to sum up.
Yeah.
But you may think in some observables which are not, which do renormalize, that you can still have convergence because of supersymmetry. And that, he's just saying that that's not true.
No, but some cancellations, even for non-protected quantities, some additional cancellations in supersymmetric theory should take place.
Yeah,
yeah, right. Yeah, sorry. So
absolutely.
I'm testing against formulation, because once you have a particular reason to cancellation, it doesn't disappear. You know, so you can discuss anomalies or whatever, but then you cannot say that it's not a guarantee. There is a statement of normalization, it is guaranteed.
No, what I meant was just exactly, I mean, of course there are observable, as you said, that they're protected, and then over there it is a guarantee, right? Non-normalization theorems are telling you.
It's more complicated because in a sense that when, say, for example, you have a chiral quantities for which you are not expecting collection beyond, say, one loop. Right?
Yeah.
However, there could be kind of this holomorphic anomaly, whatever, where you can have, so there are kind of limited possibilities.
Yeah.
Okay, but then you can follow up what is the reason.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Good. So, and in some of these cases, actually, you can, as you were saying, so in this case, maybe you expect to have some convergence, but you don't, and then you actually realize that there are some complexified BPS equations that are giving you. I'm going to review that later. Yeah, I'm going to do not these cases, because these cases were done by others. I'm just going to do the two-speed partition function, absolutely. Thank you. Good. However, there is a case in which this truncation is manifest. So it's a very simple case, simplest example. Which is something that Tim told us briefly yesterday, which is just supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And so I'm referring in this particular case to the paper in which they used the first time Cheshire cat resurgence. So it was Tin, Meetup, oh, I wrote it now, Khan, Yuya as well, and Gerald, of course. And the idea is the following. Well, we do know of an example which is supersymmetric and which actually perturbation theory does the simplest thing of all. It's zero. So the Lagrangian, of course. It's just some quantum mechanics, so you just have some bosonic coordinates with some superpotential, plus a bunch of fermions, plus some Yukawa term. And for simplicity, let me just, I'm not going to say much, because of course this is something that you guys did, but just to set up the expectations, at least for quantum mechanics. So if you just take a cubic superpotential, which gives rise to a bosonic potential, which is just a double well. So this is just W prime square. And of course, okay, this is our superpotential, 1, 0. Good. And of course, you do have, if you want, a ground state. So the ground state of this theory is just e to the plus or minus w. In this, probably in this notation. Yeah. Perfect. However, this is not a ground state, because this guy is not normalizable. This is not an element of the Hilbert space. Not normalizable. Ground state. Which is telling you that SUSY is indeed broken. However, if you just set perturbation theory, you're going to get that the perturbative expansion is zero. So in this case, SUSY is a guarantee of actually not even convergence, just truncation. So you get zero coefficients in perturbative expansion. However, as Tim told us yesterday, we do know that in here, of course, supersymmetry is broken. You get a lift of the vacuum energy. And you can compute it, and it's just given by some instanton anti-instanton configuration. So it goes like 1 over 2 pi e to the minus 2, the instanton action over g, and then I'm just copied them from your paper, a bunch of coefficients that you can compute.
Do you need the g in the Lagrangian?
Yes, I do. It's hidden somewhere in here. Yeah. Good.
Everything's 1 over g.
Yeah.
Can you get a perturbative expansion of the wave function?
You can, yeah, actually this is something that they are working on right now, absolutely. But so this is formally, whenever you give me a supersymmetric quantum mechanics, that one is your ground state candidate. However, in some cases, according to how the superpotential is, that guy sure solves the equation of motion, but is not a normalizable. It solves the Schrodinger equation, but is not normalizable.
You can perturb the expansion, you just get that, that's what I mean.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So this is an old-order summation of perturbation theory, and less finite order, it's actually a harmonic oscillator, it's some polynomial multiplying it, and to every finite order, it's normalizable. But to all orders, it blows up at infinity.
No, but because it's non-normalizable, it corresponds that there is no state with energy equals zero, right?
Correct.
Absolutely.
Consider perturbation theory in a kind of real state, then it will, this state does exist.
Of course, I mean, that guy over there has a clear ground state.
It's not zero energy, right?
No, I'm sorry, like this potential is obviously a ground state. Right? Is a bounded from below potential, so...
It is not this potential, because once you account for fermions, it is asymmetric potential.
This is my second part that I'm going to write now.
You can imply normal quantum mechanics, you can discuss what is the state, and the degeneracy, by the way, the degeneracy of fermion-bosonic degeneracy is not log.
Mm-hmm.
Because supersymmetry is spontaneously broken, but not degeneracy, right?
Yeah. Well, exactly. Spontaneously broken.
The statement of degeneracy of the fermion and it means that this potential and another potential were.
It's an expansion.
I'm going to write it down. So yeah, let me just people forget it at this point. So what I wanted to say in here that this is coming from II bar contribution. And it seems that if you just stare at this perturbative expansion, there is no way to apply resurgence to read from zero out of this one. So what this gentleman did was to deconstruct zero. So to do that, I need to split the Hilbert space into fermionic subsectors. So you just do a grading of the Hilbert space and work with a purely bosonic Lagrangian, but in a well-defined sector of the Hilbert space. So this is what I'm...
In this particular case, the answer is actually given by one instanton as well, because you can calculate, say, supercharge, and then the answer is just square root of supercharge.
Yeah, yeah, so exactly.
It makes it much simpler.
That's the easiest way to
No, in fact, this example, I mean, it's very well known. I think Witten's paper was like 84 or something. It was a long time ago. But the way in which they realize which these guys realize the how resurgence comes about is very nice and actually is the starting point of what I'm going to do. And of course, I mean, if you want this one, there are various ways of solving it. It's not necessarily the shorter one. But the way out is to use this Cheshire cut resurgence. I should not have erased that. So, split the Hilbert space using the fermion grading. So I'm going to just split it into subsector of a well-defined fermion number, K. And let me suppose over there you can generalize it to an F fermion, so you don't just need to put one. So this one is a subsector of the Hilbert space for which the fermion number is diagonal and is K. Okay, in this case, as you were saying, you have just the bosonic and the fermionic sector. Good. And once you work in a fixed fermion number subsector, you can actually write down just bosonic Hamiltonians or Lagrangians. So in each subsector, you can write a purely bosonic Hamiltonian, which is very simple. You simply need to integrate out the fermions, or if you want, this just a fermion number. So this guy in here is going to give you a contribution to the bosonic part of the potential. So now G is appearing, just I think G was 1 over G was in front of the Lagrangian. So you just get this one, W prime square. This would be the story if you only had bosons. However, since I'm working in a subsector of the Hilbert space with a well-defined number of fermions, you also get a modification of the potential, which takes this form. So this is a purely bosonic Hamiltonian. You can study all its eigenvalues. But the nice thing to realize is that actually you can analytically continue the number of fermions. So what they did, they simply declared that this guy in here is not an integer. It's neither 1 nor minus 1, for example, for the supersymmetric case over there. You just call it Z. And you study this auxiliary problem. Where Z is your favorite complex number. Or real number, doesn't really matter. So why would you do that? Because now you can actually see that something pretty nice happens. So this guy in here, for general Z, perturbation theory is not zero. It's asymptotic. Not an integer.
Oh, no.
If you compute the perturbative expansion, you get something of this form. Sum n equal to 0 infinity, an, some perturbative coefficients, which are of course a function of this parameter, g to the n, plus some non-perturbative stuff. Let me not even write it down. The key point is that for general z, an cross partorially, which was exactly the key point, the key starting point to apply resurgence. So at this point, let me just cut it short because this is what they did, and I'm gonna just to give you a little bit of a feeling what's the idea behind. So at this point, since your perturbative coefficients are factorially growing, you can apply resurgence. You can just, for example, use large order behaviors. And you can read non-perturbative data out of these perturbative coefficients. And now you see that something magical happens. You first do this, and only at the very end, you send only at the end, you can send zeta to an integer. And you will see that these perturbative coefficients truncate, but still, since you use first resurgence and then send zeta to an integer, you can actually read the non-perturbative data that are hidden in here, in this zero. So when you start directly from the supersymmetric point, everything has cancelled already. So this is why they use this analogy of the Cheshire Cat. By the way, the Cheshire Cat is a super scary figure for kids.
Can you read it also start from non-perturbative data?
Absolutely. Yeah. So in this way, you can do whatever you want, yeah. And then you will see that from the non-perturbative data, when you send zeta to zero, the perturbative coefficient goes to zero. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. No, once you're in this regime in here, sorry, general zeta, you can do whatever you want. But if you want, the rationale would be usually start from the perturbative data and generate non-perturbative physics. No, but you're absolutely right, so you can also do vice versa.
Actually, it would be helpful to write down the non-perturbative amplitude of, for example, instanton, anti-instanton for a late event.
To
it
see what happens.
Very, very, very clear to him. Can you write down the exponential minus 2
s
instanton plus minus
I.
To get to
I, I'm going to give you the same one for mine. Yeah, this was just to give us some sort of like justification for why we did what we did. Yeah.
You get something like this with the wave functions as well, though.
Oh, good. I don't know, actually. You guys didn't, because, I mean, I guess you do, right? Because you still solve using Van der Waal.
Yeah, you can set up the wave function.
Yeah, because they really set perturbation theory for both wave function and energy levels. For general zeta, you match at the same order the coefficients of the wave function and the coefficient of E. Yeah.
In principle, you can. It's just that it looks ugly. You have to you can't really have it in the closed form for general.
Yeah.
So we didn't explore too much, but we have the data.
Yeah, you have everything because you constructed wave function.
The reason I ask about other way around is to see what happened when you're using non-perturbative data, do exist even in supersymmetric case, right?
Yeah,
even
exactly.
Even that is integer. So what happened, you know, when you are going to what happened to non-perturbative data when zeta is...
Oh, they survived. They're still there, of course, because...
No, but I mean, it should be a special case, right, for non-perturbative data.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
My suspicion
absolutely. So you weren't here for my talk, but the point is that the non-perturbative things couple to phases, and these phases end up being I pi in these instances. It's e to the I zeta pi. Yeah. Uh-huh. So their imaginary parts vanish. And there's nothing to cancel from perturbation theory.
Yeah,
these are special points, but
in this way you have a signal.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I invite you to read their paper. It's really nice.
Yeah,
and absolutely. But this is not what I just wanted to give some motivation. Yeah.
Right. So from the point of view of Borel analysis, if you set out to be a complex number, you would get singularities of Borel transform.
Yeah.
And probably these integers, the singularity is just cancelled.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but it's more or less similar to what this phrase statement, right? Yeah. I think it should be related, right, due to this.
All the Stokes constant disappear. I mean, I'm going to write you. I don't want to write. Okay, I can.
Sorry.
Yeah. Good. Perfect. And the question that we want to answer is, well, can we find something similar in quantum field theory? And the answer is yes, we can, in some nice two-dimensional model. So I'm just going to give you a brief, just to set up the language. All right. So the two-dimensional model that we study is the CPN model. So first, really briefly, let me just tell you how you can realize the CPN model has a gauge linear CIMA model. So let me give you the matter content first. So the matter content is fairly simple. You have a U1 gauge multiplet, which in two dimension you can call it sigma, and is a twisted chiral. And let me just say that the lowest component is a scalar, is a complex scalar. Component is sigma, and is a complex scalar. And then you have a bunch of chiral multiplets. You have n chirals that I'm going to call capital phi I, all charged plus one under the gauge group. And I'm going to denote with little phi I the lowest component. Good. What are the parameters in here? Well, we have a coupling constant for the U1 field, which I'm going to denote as E. And remember, in two dimension, E is dimension full. That's mass dimension 1. And then we have two other parameters. One is called the Fayette-Idopoulos term, which I'm going to denote as xi, and a theta angle. And if you want, you can combine them into the holomorphic coupling, which is just I xi plus theta over 2 pi. And if you want, you have the instanton counting parameter, which I'm going to denote as t, is just the exponential, e to the 2 pi I tau. Good. So for the moment, this doesn't look anything like the CPN model. The reason why this is the CPN model is the following. So first, you want to solve for the D-term vacuum equation, which are just some equations which are telling you which one are the vacuum of the theory. And they're fairly simple. So sigma, the lowest component of the twisted chiral, is set to 0. And then you have that the sum of all these fills in here, square, has to be equal to the phi A Lyapunov. So this one just looks a little bit more like the CPN model.
You have a that's a classical solution.
Classical, yeah, absolutely. Exactly. Good. And then what's happening is that, as I told you, the coupling constant is dimension 1. So if you're interested in the IR physics, at a certain energy scale, this guy is completely frozen. So the U1 gauge field gets frozen. So you have this condition plus a non-dynamical U1 field that acts in this way. Phi 1 is equivalent to e to the I alpha phi 1 for every I between 1 and n. And these two conditions are exactly the condition to have CPN minus 1. The sum over n fields modulus square equal to some fixed number and an overall phase fixed. This is just the CPN minus 1 model. So this I didn't write it down. There are a bunch of fermions, and what turns out to be, it is an n equal to 2,2 supersymmetric CPN minus 1 model.
Yeah.
Oh, because remember, in two dimensions, the coupling constant is dimension full.
Yeah.
So if you just go at energy scales below that, mm-hmm. you're freezing completely the U1 degrees of freedom.
Well, I mean, in 1 plus 1, the U1 is not even, there's no associated particles with it. Right?
Yeah.
No polarization. I'm not sure.
But you still, you still have the covariant derivative still have the U1 gauge field, right? If you want, you can integrate it out. So you can also do that. You integrate it out, and you will see that it introduces exactly the current in the non-gauge version of the CPN model.
Right.
Yeah. But basically, since you have a 1 over e square in front of f mu square, this freezes the fluctuations, and you just impose a mu as some constraint. The phase of all, the overall phase of these guys is frozen. Is that a bit clearer?
Are you going to send e to 0?
No, actually, it goes to infinity.
Oh, sorry.
There are.
Yeah.
Yeah, now psi now, what's happening with what I'm going to write down now? Psi plays the role of the coupling constant of the CPN model. Yeah, well, no, actually, no.
Can you write it down?
You can write it down, yeah, absolutely. Oh, yeah, of course. Good, so you have like 1 over e square, f mu square, plus, it's very simple, you have like d mu phi I mod square, where d mu is just the covariant derivative, maybe without E, of the field phi I. And then you have some auxiliary fields that basically give you those other conditions.
But you don't consider twisted mass, right?
No, I don't. Exactly. That's a great point. Yeah, I'm not going to consider twisted masses. Yeah. That's another. So from the supersymmetric point of view, you can put them, and nothing changes. Yeah. We wanted to study the one without twisted masses just because it's a little bit simpler. But you can. So the two-sphere partition function, which is what I'm going to review now, you can compute it with any twisted masses. Yeah. There are a few subtleties, but you can put them there. Yeah. Good. So yeah, the thing that I wanted to say, so plus, okay, fermions plus auxiliary fields. And the thing that I want to mention is that from here, from this condition, you actually read that the coupling constant, let me call it G, of the CPN minus 1 model is related to the phi A Lyapunov. So you have 1 over G square equal to 2 pi whatever psi. So the key point is that weak coupling means very large Xi. So these are almost flat manifolds. So weak coupling is Xi much, much bigger than 1. Good. And then has Misha was saying, this is just the classical version. Quantum mechanically is behaving exactly like QCD, almost exactly like QCD. So you have a dynamically generated scale, which is related to the phi A Lyapunov, or the coupling constant of the CPN model. Good. And so you do have mass gap. You do expect renormalons. Don't yell at me, Tim. I just meant it that like you would expect to have poles on the positive line of the Borel transform. And there were various papers already by Gerald and Mittad on the resurgence properties of this model, or the non-supersymmetric version of it. But the thing...
But in supersymmetry, the beta function is one loop.
Exactly, exactly. Yeah, so if you want, I actually wrote it down. In this model, the beta function is one loop XX, so this is a good point. This target space, the vacuum fluctuations, is a CPM manifold, which is not a Calabi-Yau manifold, of course, which means that the beta function is not zero. So the beta function is like Xi renormalized is equal to Xi there, plus generically we have a sum over all the charges of your fields, that in this case is just n over 2 pi log lambda over mu. Perfect. And so this is why you would have a dynamically generated mass scale, lambda, which is related to the renormalized Fayyadopoulos. But this is a one-loop exact calculation. Yeah. The thing that you can use, though, in this formulation is supersymmetric localization, which is what I want to use now. Let me just give you a ultra crash course on supersymmetric localization. So the key idea is, suppose that you have a symmetry which is nilpotent. Q squared is equal to zero. It doesn't need to be Q squared equal to zero, but whatever. What can you do with that? Well, you can try to deform the path integral so that actually behaves nicer. So suppose that I give you a path integral of this form, and I know that there is a symmetry whose square is zero. Well, then I can try to add a term which is a Q exact term. I choose some field configuration, some polynomial in fields, whatever, call it V, and I just take P times Q of V. So this is a different path integral. However, using this property, you can actually show that d by dt of this one, which is very simple, is just the insertion of this Q exact term. This is actually equal to zero. So you write it as it does depend on t, but it doesn't actually. For the mathematician, this is just Twisterman-Heckmann localization. Oh, basically, as always, so if you want, this is the expectation value of the variation of V. And as always, you can move Q on the other side. Q acting on the measure is zero, no anomalies. Q acting on the Lagrange, on the action, is zero because it was a symmetry. Q acting on this one is zero because Q squared is zero. Think about BRST, if you want.
Could be it is still integral, because third part is integral over space, right?
Yeah.
The part could be...
It's still, yeah. So V, if you want, so generically V takes this form.
V it is integral, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's an integral over your space. For me, it's going to be some two-dimensional. This is a nice thing. It's a little bit of an art in supersymmetric localization. You have to, in principle, you can choose whatever V you want. Okay. However, the supersymmetric logic in which your path integral is going to localize depends on V. So, for example, for BRST, you don't gain anything. So for BRST, you do have a Q squared, which is equal to zero.
Yeah.
And this is just gauge invariance. So you just localize on gauge orbits.
Yes.
Good, they're still infinite dimensional. Uh-huh. In supersymmetric localization, if you choose a smart V, you actually localize the path integral on finite dimensional integrals. That's a key point, yeah.
Is here crucial that you don't have to gain a
It is. You need to. Yes, exactly. So this is the second bit. This is the second bit of the art of supersymmetric localization. Is generically you want to put your theory on some manifold while preserving some supercharge. which supercharge you have to preserve depends a little bit on the theory that you're considering and on the manifold that you want to put it on. So in some cases, you can preserve, actually in all those cases, though this is the two-dimensional case, you can preserve one supercharge. The price to pay is that you cannot turn on all the parameters. So for example, for the twisted masses, you can only turn on the real part of the twisted masses. But still, it's unbroken, so it's a symmetry.
Yeah, but part of supersymmetry would be broken, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, it's explicitly broken because you're putting your theory on a curve manifold. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah.
My question is, yeah? Does it work for theories where supersymmetry is not broken explicitly? I'm asking whether the ground state can break SUSY. So, for example, could you apply it for the case where there's spontaneous SUSY breaking in the ground? Because naively, I mean, you would have in partition function.
Yeah.
This is an insertion of Q in the partition function.
Mm-hmm.
And if the ground state doesn't break SUSY, Q annihilates the ground state. But it doesn't. There will be matrix elements which survive here.
Good. So. It's a little bit dangerous to think about like the ground state. This, what I'm going to consider, is going to be the two-sphere partition function. I don't really have a Hilbert space interpretation of that one. You see, you don't have a circle over there. So your path integral is not really generating matrix elements. But I think you can, yeah, it doesn't really matter what the ground state is. So there are a few cases in which, so generically, whenever you put it on some curved manifold, it's going to select for you a particular vacuum. It's not really obvious from the procedure which vacuum it's going to select. So there are actually cases in which they're called the bad, ugly, and good theories. In which actually you don't quite know which vacuum you're selecting. There was a recent paper by Stefano Cremonesi and oh. Say again? Thank you. In which they were able actually to see that from the supersymmetric localized point of view, the theory was actually selecting one particular vacuum. But you don't know it a priori, which one. Yeah.
And can you apply the procedure to quantum mechanics as well?
You can, yeah. Yeah.
So there's a Parisian SU.
Yes, it's very similar.
Reduction is
yes, exactly. Yeah, that's a nice point. Yeah. Good. So why do I say that this is localization? Because of the following argument. So if this does not depend on T, then it means that Z of T is equal to Z of 0, which is my original path integral. But I can also take the limit for T going to infinity of Z of T. And the key point now is that the path integral localizes on particular saddle points. So the saddle point approximation becomes exact in this limit. So saddle point approximation is exact. And you can write your path integral as a sum over phi naught e to the minus s of phi naught times, let me write like this, determinant of O fermionic over determinant of O bosonic. When in here, I simply say phi naught are the critical points of QV with action QV equal to 0. Because of course, if I'm sending T to infinity, any saddle point, or let me put a minus sign maybe in here. Any saddle point for which QV is different from 0, it's going to contribute 0 because you're sending T to infinity.
But you also have integral over modulus.
Absolutely. Yeah, exactly. So in here, you're absolutely right. Quote unquote. For example, once again, BRST, you still have a path integral.
Yeah.
But generically, if you choose smartly, this sum is going to become really a sum plus some integral over the moduli. And this is exactly what I'm going to show you now. And so good. So this is just, if you want, the saddle point action. And this is just the quadratic fluctuation operator. Which I'm going to refer equivalently to the one-loop determinant. So the saddle point approximation is exact in this limit.
Integral?
Which integral?
So now you have holes in the determinant.
Excellent. So that's the whole point of the story. Yeah, you need to study.
If you look at capital, so the significance acceleration of determinant is also 1.
Good. Not quite. Yeah. You're absolutely right. So generically, you think that this determinant cancels exactly, but it doesn't actually. Yeah. So the key point was, as I said, you need to find Q, you need to find a smart V, and luckily for me, Stefano Cremonesi, Francesco Benini, Sanjay Lee, Nima Dorud, Gomis, and someone else that I forgot, Le Floch, did that for us in two dimensions on the two sphere. For a big class of n equal to 2,2 supersymmetric theories. So, here, what happens is that on the two-sphere punchline, this sum that I wrote in here really is a sum over topological sectors plus an integral over, times an integral over the moduli. So, let me just write in here. The path integral, after being localized, becomes a sum over magnetic fluxes times an integral over d sigma. Where sigma, so remember, there were all these fields in the theory, the one I wrote before. What are the saddle points of the supersymmetric localization equation of motion? They're very simple. The field strength is just B over R square. R is the radius of the two sphere. Sigma of X, which was the lowest component of a field, is not a field anymore, is a constant, sigma. And okay, the auxiliary field D is just this guy here. All the other fields are zero. So you see that I wrote a sum before. It's not quite a sum, but it's not even a path integral. So the full path integral localizes over a discrete sum over topological sectors and an integral over the Cartan. And if you actually compute the one-loop determinants, you can write your partition function in the following way. It's a sum, e to the minus I, theta b, so these are the topological sectors, and then an integral over the only field that you're left, but is a constant field, the on-shell action, so this is just the on-shell action, and then the one-loop determinant, which in this case is just a ratio of gamma functions. So this is the one loop determinant, or if you want, this is just the quadratic fluctuation operator.
But it means that this, in terms of modes, it means that the degeneracy is broken,
yeah.
In this case?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. Yeah. So the determinant for the gauge fluctuation, because also you have to take the determinant of the gauge genus over the gauge field, that is 1, that over cancel. But for the matter field, it doesn't. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. What is sigma again?
Good. So at the beginning, you have a bunch of fields, right? And in principle, you have to do the path integral over all of them. But if you find a smart V and you look for the supersymmetric loci of that V, fixes you F12 to be just some integer. Sigma of X is not a field, it's just a number sigma that I still need to integrate over. Because remember,
what was it in the original?
Oh, it's the lowest component of the twisted chiral field.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's just a complex scalar. Good.
Do you see that the integral converges?
This integral does converge, yeah. Yes, yes. So this actually was. So if you study the properties of these integrals, there are a bunch of poles on the imaginary line, and a bunch of zeros on the positive line. And this integral does indeed converge. So let me just give you, so these are sum of poles. You can actually close it down this way. And you just get a bunch of residues. And let me just give you, for example, for CP1, you get something like this. Twice the I0 of 2 square root of t, k0 of 2 square root of t bar, plus the I0 of 2 square root of t bar, the k0 of 2 square root of t. But remember, t was just the instant on counting parameter. It's e to the minus 2 pi c plus I theta. So let me just make a couple of comments. Good. I don't want to write them down.
So here everything is exponential in this answer.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So if you want, you can expand it. This is what I'm going to do next. But first, I wanted to make a couple of comments on this one. So the first thing that you can actually check is that the chiral ring structure is there. So for the one of you who don't know what the chiral ring structure means, don't worry. I'm just going to give like two equations. So basically, if you look at the original path integral, the action can be written in this way. The action is log of t times the integral over d2x d2 theta of sigma plus Hermitian conjugate plus q exact stuff. So I just want to highlight the dependence on t. So from the partition function point of view, you can start taking derivative with respect to t. What's going to happen? You bring down this field sigma. And so if you compute t dt of the partition function divided by z, you just get an insertion of sigma. So if you do it in here, you know how to derive Bessel functions. Let me not even write it down. You do it twice. You bring down sigma square. And you think, in principle, you could continue. But actually, what happens is that for CP1, which is the case that I wrote in here, this guy in here is nothing but t, which, if you want to write it down in terms of lambda QCD, is just lambda square. And this is exactly the expected chiral ring structure for CP1.
But this t, it's not the t which was originally for Clue exact tor, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's another
yeah.
Right?
It's defined it here.
Yeah, I understand. But when you consider this other t to be large.
Oh, no, it's not this one.
You are neglecting this tor, right?
No, so that one was the parameter for the supersymmetric localization.
Yeah.
I already sent it to infinity.
So in this way, but if you send it to infinity, then this Q-exact term, it is a dominant one, right? Or
no, exactly. So I should have used maybe a different uh-huh. a different name for that one. Uh-huh. So let me rewrite it as little s. So this was the integral of e to the minus s of phi plus s q of v.
And now you have action.
all right, x. Now this is the space-time coordinate, right? Good.
It's not the same x as the quantum.
Yes, exactly. It's exactly that one. Very good question. So take this x, you send it first to infinity,
yeah.
And you look at the Lotchi qv equal to 0. So I've already done that.
I see.
However, everything that is q exact is still going to drop from my action.
I see.
And the only term that is not q exact is this term in here. So if you start taking derivative respect to t, you bring down these operators. If you want, this is the analog of the Gluino condensate in QCD. And you see that generically, classically, you would expect this guy to be 0, just because of fermionic 0 modes. But actually, because of instanton corrections, it's non-perturbative. And it's just lambda square.
This is the...
Where is the phrase?
Okay.
Excuse me.
Michel, you can go here.
Oh, I just wanted to say that where are n vacuums?
Yeah.
I mean, the phrase, you missed the phrase, right?
No, this is the complexified dynamically generated scale. You're absolutely right. No, this is a complex number.
Right, but it's not just complex number, it has all the n values, right?
Yeah.
Which is not written here, right?
Yes.
So it's in, it's not arbitrary number.
I'll tell you, in CP n minus 1, it would be sigma to the n.
So this is what I was going to write now.
Yeah.
So from this function in here, you just write it as sum over poles, and for CP n minus 1, you start computing this one, t dt to the nth power applied to z, divided by z. This would be the insertion of sigma to the n, and this is t once again, which is, if you want, lambda to the n. That's the key point. So this is your n bucket.
This is the in some sense, the sigma is similar counterpart of this Venezian Yankee.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. It's lambda lambda, as I was saying. Yeah. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Good. So, okay, this is a good check. There's nothing to do with the resurgence. It's simply that, you know, the partition function does contain information, at least for the chiral ring.
What is E in the
formal argument
of I
naught? So, T.
T bar.
T bar is the complex conjugate of T.
Okay, sorry.
No worries. Good. Also, my handwriting is terrible, so... Good, so this was just a comment. The second comment that I want to make, mostly for you, is that we can actually compute what they're called the TT star equation. Unfortunately, this T, I mean, is related to the T that I'm using, is not quite exactly the same. For you, like, read it, that is exactly the same. So, in this case, if you compute the CP1 partition function, it doesn't quite solve the TT star equation. Let me just make this little comment, and I don't have an answer for that. But if you compute these TT star equations, basically in this case, they simply read TT bar DT DT bar log ZCP1. This is, let me write this, 0 times TT bar Z square CP1 minus 1 over Z CP1 square. So, in the Chakotay-Wafa notation, this would be what they write, dz, dz bar of q is equal to 0 e to the 2q minus e to the minus 2q. So, the TT star equation for CPN are some periodic toda. For CP1, it's just a Sinch Gordon. For us, I don't have really a good argument why, but for us, it happens that the first term is missing. This is the thing that you're only getting out from the localized two-sphere partition function. And this is not quite what you find instead in the superconformal case. So in the case in which the target is some Calabi-Yau, that one is a conformal field theory. The beta function vanishes, you compute the two-sphere partition function, and in the superconformal case, Gomis and Lee showed that the two-sphere localized partition function is E to the Keller potential of the Calabi-Yau, and this is exactly what TT star is telling you in that case. In our case, it's not a conformal field theory, it's an asymptotically free theory. There is no reason a priori to expect the TT star equation to be satisfied, but it's surprising that we find something very similar to that. But okay, this is just a comment. So, finally, I can tell you about the resurgent point of view. So, as I wrote down this partition function, it's actually a little bit misleading because the coupling constant that I wrote down is not just the coupling constant. It contains the coupling constant and theta. So, of course, you want to disentangle the two. You want to write down your partition function as this resurgence triangle. So, if you go back to the CP1 case, you can actually write your partition function as a sum over Fourier modes. So you simply sum over topological sectors, what you would call a d-instanton sector, times a function, which of course depends on which sector you are in, but is only a function of the Fayette-Idopoulos, so it's only a function of the coupling constant. So the only dependence on theta is in here. You write it as a sum over, this is what you would call a b-instanton, times a perturbative expansion around the b-instanton. So this is what Gerand and Mitat called the resurgence triangle.
Yeah. Would be theta plus pi theta would be holomorphic dependence?
Yes, exactly. So I simply, in this way, I'm splitting out. I'm not writing it anymore as a holomorphic function.
But the answer would be holomorphic?
Oh, no, it's not holomorphic. As I wrote it before, it's holomorphic times anti-holomorphic plus something else. So you cannot split. No, exactly. Yeah. You can, yeah, if you write it as the vortex.
Okay, but then, in this sense, holomorphicity in each one?
Yeah. But I don't want to use holomorphicity now because I want to do a weak coupling expansion. Uh-huh. And I want to do a weak coupling expansion topological sector by topological sector. Because the resurgence is going to work in these columns of the...
I can see that the Bessel was a simple form of Bessel function.
No, excellent. So actually, what I'm going to write now is that zeta of C is a polynomial in C. Yeah.
How can you get Bessel functions?
You have an infinite sum over B. Okay. And this does depend on B. So it's a polynomial whose coefficient depends on B. Remember, the argument of the Bessel function was not C, was this E to this holomorphic coupling, yeah. Good, so as I was saying, so if I divide into different topological sector, then I have this resurgence triangle. So this is the perturbative expansion, and then I will have II bar, II bar square, and resurgence should work column by column. In this way, I'm going to have I, then I will have I bar square, and so on. And here I have I bar. And I have I bar square.
So, what is your coupling constant?
C, 1 over C.
But,
yeah.
Are you relying on the fact that you can localize this
yeah,
large,
heavily.
That this is actually weakly coupled?
So, yes.
So, in other words, is your T infinite now or is it finite?
At this point, doesn't matter. T is whatever. Actually, the weird thing is that you can actually extrapolate also to negative C, which would mean a size of the CPN model negative, for which the CPN model description stops working, but you have a dual description in terms of Landau-Ginzburg.
Sorry, I meant the original T, which you called X now.
That one is gone already. That one you have to send it to infinity, right?
Okay.
That's to do localization. That one is gone. Yes, exactly. Now my parameters are xi and theta. Okay, the weak coupling, so this is valid for any xi and theta. Mm-hmm. However, the weak coupling calculation of like really CPN at weak coupling correspond to xi going to infinity. So this is what I'm going to do now. But as I was saying, so first you want to split into topological sectors and work column by column. The thing is, so if I write down, for example, the perturbative column, so if I write down this column in here, what you would call really the perturbative. So this is the perturbative part, this is II bar, so something that does not depend on theta. If you write down this function, turns out that is indeed a sum over infinitely many instanton, anti-instanton events. Each one of them multiplied by its own perturbative expansion. However, the perturbative expansion truncates. Okay, it doesn't really matter the actual numbers, but.
But when you're calculating this perturbative expansion, it's a function, at the end of the day, you have only lambda, right?
Yeah.
Which is dimensionful.
Yeah.
So in this way, zeta would be log of lambda divided by what?
Yeah.
Because I'm lacking, you know.
Oh, dimension.
Divided by what?
So, as I was saying,
Cut off, right?
Good. The radius of the sphere.
Sorry?
1 over the radius of the sphere. Yeah, absolutely. Sorry, I didn't say that.
Okay.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. Yes. No, in here you can really treat it as a number. So that one is fixed. Yeah.
So you're working in small sphere.
No. So
small radius of the sphere.
If you want, so at this point, forget about the sphere. I'm giving you this. Expansion in here, where xi is your weak coupling, strong coupling number.
Right, but what is to make psi small? What
yeah,
do you have to
radius of the sphere.
Okay, so you're expanding around small radius.
Good, but you can forget about that. So this is now like you can really see it as.
It's a physical thing. I want to remember.
It's true. Yeah. All right. Good.
But you see, in the end, the CPN, C, if you consider the C itself, there is a gap, right?
Yeah.
So in this way, you have lambda, and that's it, right?
Yeah.
So there is not, because everything is in units of lambda. Right?
Good. Not quite, right? Because you have the radius of the sphere. So if you want
the sphere, it is in this way. There is a limit where the radius goes to infinity as well.
Right.
Compared to lambda.
Yeah.
So if you want, I wrote it before. So the renormalized one is the bare one, let's say at the scale 1 over r plus n over 2 pi log of r lambda.
Uh-huh.
And I'm working with that guy over there, psi r.
Okay.
or if you want lambda.
Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. Good. So the only thing is that the perturbative coefficient, so in here you see that you do, for example, you can work with any column, it doesn't really matter. Let me just focus on the purely perturbative one. You get infinitely many non-perturbative corrections. Each one of them is accompanied by a perturbative series in 1 over Xi, but it truncates after two terms. And sorry, HK are just the harmonic numbers. Doesn't really matter. So it looks once again that we have infinitely many non-perturbative corrections, but there is apparently no way to generate them just from the perturbative expansion. And what we did now, we actually repeated a very similar story to what you guys did. We introduced an imbalance between number of bosons and fermions. And immediately, as soon as it's unbalanced, we're going to generate infinite asymptotic series.
But when you did it, you are breaking regional simplicity, so simply speaking, localization.
Excellent. That's a great point. So for the moment, what we're doing is we first localize, and then we introduce this imbalance. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. So it will be, and what I'm going to say, very likely, I'm not going to say, but if you do that, you close your eyes, you do that. And then you take this deformation parameter to zero, you find a supersymmetric result, but you also find other supposedly supersymmetric observable that you're inserting. But we don't have a path integral derivation for that. Yeah.
So what are these
vortex and anti-vortex? Yeah, exactly. Vortex anti-vortex. Yeah, instant or anti-instant, if you want. Yeah.
So you wouldn't be able to see it if you just work with a half of a sphere.
That's good. So, yeah, I think Francesco had a paper on the disk, right? Yeah, we haven't checked. So the reason why we work on the two sphere at the beginning is because we really wanted to show TT star, and then it failed, but then we found this other story. Yeah, that's an interesting question. We haven't seen on the hemisphere, yeah. Good, so how can I break supersymmetry now? Let me keep that one. So what we did, we went back to the original path integral after having localized, and the one loop determinant, let me write it simply as O psi over the determinant of O phi to the nth power. At this point, so this is the quadratic fluctuation determinant after you have localized. And the thing you can do, so generically you would compute it using the index theorem because you have supersymmetry, but in this case we want to break supersymmetry. However, on the two sphere you can write these determinants as infinite products. You really compute the eigenvalues of the quadratic operators with their degeneracy. So for example, that O phi, you can write it as the product JB all the way to infinity of J minus I sigma to the 2J plus 1, and then J plus 1 plus I sigma to the 2J plus 1. So you put the theory, you localized, and you just look at quadratic fluctuations of an operator. This operator is some Laplacian on the two sphere. You just put spherical harmonics. These are the eigenvalues, and these are the degeneracies of the eigenvalues. So at this stage, what we declared? Well, we just broke supersymmetry by hand. We simply said, well, okay, let me suppose that I have an unequal number of bosons and fermions. So we simply said, suppose that we have the determinant of O psi over the determinant of O phi to the n times the determinant of O phi to the minus delta. So this is equivalent to saying that you have n fermions and n minus delta bosons.
Well, you could have done the other way around, right? I mean,
is it the same, no? Yeah, so it's actually not quite the same. That what you see later on is that if you send delta to any positive integer, you get a better truncation. So each topological set truncates earlier. If you send delta to a negative integer, you get lower, like higher and higher truncation. So the higher the topological sector, the more perturbative coefficients you have. So this suggests that, this is why I was saying that we don't have a path integral derivation, but this suggests that whatever operator you're inserting, when delta reaches a positive integer, is like a fermionic operator. When delta is a negative integer, it's like a bosonic operator. It's very similar to the quasi-exact solvability that you guys find.
And wait a second, so it's not asymptotic in this integer?
No, it's not. It's only asymptotic when delta is a general number. Yeah. This is why I was saying that perhaps there is a semi-classical interpretation.
So an integer delta is like it's certain something.
Yeah, exactly. We don't know. So as we were saying, it looks like really you truncate more. It looks like you're inserting some Wilson line in some representation, but we don't know the original path integral. As you said, first this is breaking supersymmetry. You couldn't use, but somehow the end result is supersymmetric in a certain sense. All right. Any question? Okay.
This number of fermions bosons correspond to the number of bosons from the original theory?
If you want, yes. But it's only after you've localized, so I wouldn't go that far. But in terms, you see, for every boson, actually, I should say, for every boson of the chiral matter, you do get a 1 over determinant. For every fermion in the chiral multiplet, you get a determinant over opsi. But to do the whole story of localization, you needed to have an equal number. You needed to construct Q. So
the localization doesn't go through this?
Oh, no, because we just do it after we have localized. We insert something after having localized.
No, exactly.
So we tried to back engineer, reverse engineer whatever operator, but we couldn't find it. Yeah.
You can't have that Q exactly.
But the point is that
it cannot be Q exact.
If you're interested in supersymmetric limit, you're just using this to see what non-trivial stuff you have using research. Okay. It doesn't matter how you break Susie. Mm-hmm. It doesn't break it matter. In principle,
yeah.
We're going to take the Susie limit of the
end. True. Yeah.
It's remarkable is that even at these integer
values, absolutely.
You're finding something special.
Which truncates, yeah.
Integer values,
yes. So this is why it was suggested that somehow we have inserted some supersymmetric observable, but we don't know which one. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so at this point, you don't use index theorem. You just compute this infinite product. So let me just write something that's gonna. So these are the two type of infinite product that you have for delta generic. And then you simply say this is exponential. You just use zeta function regularization. And this is just the square root of 2 pi over gamma. And this one is the exponential. And this is just some di gamma plus something entire in A. Let me not even write it down. Where this is just the Hurwitz zeta. So you see, you cannot use, of course, index theorem because now you're breaking supersymmetry. However, you can still compute these one-loop determinants. And surprisingly, they look very similar to the determinants that you find on ADS2. So this psi minus 2 is just the integral of all gamma. And so as soon as you introduce this delta, you generate asymptotic series. This term in here, this second term in here, is only present whenever we introduce delta. This term in here was the term that we were finding when delta was 0. So this stage, we can write this deformed partition function in the following way. You can just write it as sum over the topological sectors e to the minus I theta b integral over your integration to pi e to the minus 4 pi I x c sigma. And then we have, exactly as I was saying, this determinant of op psi over determinant of op phi to the n times the determinant of op phi to the minus delta. And this, let me call it one loop determinant, which is now a function also of delta. And OK, I can write it down. It's not particularly illuminating. that it has this form, is the unperturbed case, gamma over gamma to the nth power. But then you introduce nasty stuff, 2i sigma log gamma minus log gamma. Yeah.
Multiplication determinant of pi.
Yeah, you have a similar expression for op psi.
Looks to me that the power determinant of the bosonic term in our cluster.
Thank you, yeah.
Operators would be the same operator, right? The determinant would be, no, I mean, kind of theory, the ratio of the
two. No, no, they're not the same operator, because when you put it on the two sphere, the two quadratic fluctuations operator are almost the same, but not quite. So the ratio simplifies dramatically. You see here that the terms that I was writing, so you have
side. So the sphere breaks with the symmetry.
Yeah. So, but even when you send delta to zero, so you have really the supersymmetric case, the one loop determinant is still not one. It's this ratio of gamma function. Yeah, exactly. But the nice thing is that now whenever delta is present, we do have these two new functions appearing. Log gamma of the argument that I don't even write down, and this di gamma function. So the structure is now the following. You have two branch cuts. And you're taking this contour of integration. So this is in the sigma plane. And at this point, we can really write it down in terms of a trans series. So yeah, let me cut it a little bit shorter. So at this point, we really write down this integral. These functions in here, the log gamma and the psi, have discontinuities across this cut. This one loop determinant has poles, but you can still write it in a trans series form. And everything becomes automatically asymptotic. As soon as delta is not zero or an integer, all our perturbative expansions are going to be asymptotic. So, I can close this contour of integration on either side. I just need to use the discontinuity properties of log gamma and the di gamma function, which I think I also wrote them down. It's not particularly important. But if you take log gamma of minus x plus I epsilon minus log gamma of minus x plus minus I epsilon, you simply get minus 2 pi I the floor of x plus 1. And a similar formula for the psi gamma. So at this point, you can compute this integral, and you can write down, so let me just focus on the purely topologically trivial sector, and you write it as an infinite sum of exponentially suppressed contributions, a trans series parameter, which depends on delta, and then some lateral Borel summation. Where this lateral Borel summation now takes the following form. It's the integral between 0 and infinity in the plus or minus I epsilon direction, dx, e to the minus 4 pi xc x, x to the minus n plus delta, 2k plus 1, and then some Borel transform that depends on the instanton sector that you're working in, of course. So this was simply generated by considering this integral and moving one of the two contours across the cut and using the discontinuity equations. Good, and let me just write down, for example, explicitly what this phi zero function is. So the key point is that, for example, phi 0 the purely perturbative Borel transform goes like sine pi delta divided by pi times, okay, the undeformed case, gamma 1 plus x squared. So this is for CP1, for example. Times two functions, let me call them f1 of x and f2 of x. So these two functions have branch cuts along the positive real line starting at 1 and along the negative real line starting at minus 1. So the radius of convergence of this guy is 1. And the singularity structure in this new plane, I simply rotated the plane, is the following. The Borel transforms in every topological sector have radius of convergence 1. And have two branch cuts, one in the positive direction, they're simply coming from this log gamma and this da gamma in here. But at this point, we can just usually do the same, like always the same trick. We expand this for small x, we commute the sum with the integral, and we see what's happening. And what is happening is that we generate asymptotic series, but we have to be careful because in front we have a term that goes to 0, sine of pi delta. And this is exactly the same situation that you guys found. So, if you expand for large xi, you get, let me just write down, for example, the perturbative expansion only. You get that the perturbative expansion takes this form, this 4 pi xi to the n minus delta, and then an infinite series of some perturbative coefficients, which are, of course, a function of delta, divided by 4 pi xi to the n plus 1. And these perturbative coefficients look like this. They are pi sine pi delta times gamma of n plus 1 minus n plus delta times some other coefficient. So I simply expanded the Borel transform, did the Laplace integral, and no surprise, you generate asymptotic behavior. But now the thing is that you have to be careful, because you see in here that for general delta, this is really a factorial growth. But for delta integer, this is zero, but this gamma function produces poles. How many poles do you produce? Well, as soon as n plus 1 minus n is smaller or equal than 0. So this gives you poles, and this gives you 0, as delta goes to 0. So first thing, you can also see what I was telling you before. Delta goes to an integer, the same story happens, any integer. So if you send delta to 1, this actually generates for you one more coefficient. Delta goes to minus 1, no, sorry, vice versa. If you send delta to 1, this guy in here is not a pole for fewer terms, and vice versa. So you generate asymptotic series as soon as delta is not an integer. But since we have asymptotic series, so we checked, it's very simple to check that you have cancellation of ambiguities. So indeed, the perturbative sector contains all the non-perturbative information. And also, what you can do the usual dispersion relations as yesterday. You just write down the perturbative coefficients in terms of the non-perturbative ones. So for example, if I just focus on the perturbative coefficients, we just use the standard large order growth. And for n much, much bigger than 1, they go like sine pi delta gamma of n minus 2 delta divided by, let me write this, plus 1, the n minus 2 delta. And then you start generating new coefficients, which I'm going to call with a new index 1, to denote that these are nothing but the perturbative coefficients on the non-perturbative sector. But of course, everything is a function of delta. And then, of course, you generate higher instantons. But you see that all the Stokes constants vanish when delta goes to 0, which is exactly this example of Cheshire cat resurgence. Minus 1, and so on. So this is very similar to the large order behavior that you found in quantum mechanics. The perturbative coefficients, as soon as delta is not 0 or an integer, they're asymptotic. They go like factorially, and then you can read the non-perturbative coefficients of the one instanton sector, actually, sorry, it's II bar sector, of the two instanton sector, and so on. However, when you send delta to 0, all the Stokes constant vanish. This is why whenever you start directly from the supersymmetric case, the body of the Cheshire cat is already disappeared. You cannot see anything. You go away from the supersymmetric case, you use large order, and now, from these coefficients in here, we can generate as many as you want, you can read these terms and send delta to 0 for these terms. And this is going to give you the perturbative coefficients on the non-perturbative sectors in the supersymmetric case, which, of course, it was impossible at the beginning because you had polynomials, and polynomials, they didn't tell you anything. So,
I have a question.
Yeah.
So when you take n to be some integer,
yeah.
In the structure that we found in the quantum mechanical system, if we change number of Fermi's flavors to 3, 4, so and so, these were the lowest NF states were convergent,
yeah.
And they were related to this quasi-exact solvability.
Yeah.
So for all of them, we have convergence. In supersymmetric case, happens to be a special case of that where you have only one state,
yeah.
Which is special. What is the exact counterpart of these states which are convergent?
Good. So this would be these supersymmetric observables that I was telling you. So let me just write down the general formula for the perturbative coefficients in a non-perturbative sector. So let me say in the K instanton anti-instanton sector, the coefficient go in this way. They go like sine pi delta 2k plus 1 gamma n plus 1 plus 2k plus 1 delta minus n times something which is finite. So you see that now if you send delta to a positive integer, the higher the topological sector, the bigger this integer is going to be. So fix n, for example, to be 2. So we are discussing CP1. So let me fix it. This is 1. Sorry. Thank you. 2. So this gamma in here is going to give you something non-zero. Sorry. It's going to give you not a pole whenever this term in here is bigger than 2.
Yeah, exactly.
But you see that for higher k,
it's
impossible, right? If you send delta to 1, it's impossible. Vice versa, if you send delta to minus 1, the higher k, you're going to have more and more terms.
Yeah.
So this is somehow the analog. In each of these topological sectors, sorry, these, I shouldn't call them topological sector. In each of these non-perturbative sectors, if you send delta to an integer, positive or negative, you do generate more and more terms, but always finitely many.
So
this is why I was saying that it looks like you're inserting some sort of fermionic observable. So the higher non-perturbative sectors receive fewer contributions, or a bosonic one, but we don't know which one.
Okay. I'll make one more remark.
Uh-huh.
This is actually very interesting. In QCD adjoint, the deformation that you are doing for super young yields is adding just more flavors, okay, fermionic flavors. That explicitly breaks supersymmetry, but still there is an immense structure in the Hilbert space. So if you take CPN, n equal to comma 2, add more fermion flavors, you lose supersymmetry. But On the other hand, if you calculate, for example, neutral white amplitude, you see that they become unambiguous. So these phases are, when NF not integer, these phases are related to resurgence, but when they are integer, they become hidden topological angles. And it sort of suggests that these non-supersymmetric theories are extremely special.
Yeah.
This class of non-supersymmetric theories are not yet special of supersymmetric, perhaps, but extremely special.
I don't know, here we try, you see, the problem is that in here, first you localize, and then you add this operator, which is written as an infinite product. And then you try to reverse engineer whatever operator at the beginning was giving you this one. And this is why we are not able to do that.
Just to clarify, I think he's of the opinion that what they are doing with this in the original theory doesn't amount to changing the theory, but inserting...
Oh, no, you can see it, so you could see it both ways.
Yeah, but delta is the deficit of the boson fermion, so you can see it the same way.
No, of course, I mean...
But we can't see this because localization will break down.
That is the reason why, right? So if you were to begin from, if you were to begin with two bosons and one fermion,
why do I make the comment I make then? My comment did not rely on localization.
That's true.
I made a comment about neutral bion amplitudes and whether they were ambiguous or not, depending on this deficit delta. So I said that they become unambiguous at some point. So this already suggests that there is something very special about this.
But you see, this is a bold claim to say that by putting delta over there, I'm giving you the result of the two boson one fermion case. So this is why we didn't make it. But I see your point. Yeah, that's a good point.
Excuse me, I also have a question.
Two questions.
I understand that you put your theory on a sphere.
Yeah.
And it was a way to make it infrared regularized.
Yes.
But there is another way. It's adding twisted masses instead of the sphere. And it's perfectly a sensible theory.
Absolutely.
So that Lagrangian, there is no abnormalities or everything is known about it, at least at Lagrangian.
Yeah. I have your papers on that in my office.
The basic of your approach, when the one instanton contribution becomes ill-defined. That's because with the twisted masses, the one instanton action becomes logarithmically divergent. So,
infrared or where?
In infrared, at large size.
I see.
So the question is, have you ever thought, of trying to develop some kind of the instanton calculus?
Yeah,
the supersymmetry is the same.
Absolutely,
You can introduce these twisted masses in the ZN symmetric.
Yeah, it's basically the lowest component of some other twisted Keiler, right? Or the upper component, I forgot. You can see that, But, Cremonesi, Benini, and Lee and company, they did the general case with twisted masses.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. The only thing you have to be careful about is when you put the theory on the two sphere,
you don't need to.
I understand, but I also want to find a regime where I can compute everything exactly, which was this supersymmetric localization.
Well, we are talking now about just to begin with, just one instanton.
Okay.
About localization. One instanton should be understood. In any way, because it's
absolutely
the minimal building block of the whole procedure.
And moreover, in your approach, this sphere,
it's not my approach.
It's at one instanton, right? But the question is that in certain ways, one you need then localization, because if you took a sphere, as you were suggesting, a small radius, right? You automatically has a weak outline, right?
Mm-hmm.
So in this sense, you can say that center point dominates for small sphere without...
It's only for one instanton, but he wants to have any number.
All of them,
The counting is small, so in this way it justifies center points
for any instanton. But technically it's much simpler, to do it for...
But he also wants a large order of perturbation theory. How are you going to do that even if you have decoupling in quantum field theories? This is very difficult.
No, but I think Misha's point was that not even to compute the first non-perturbative correction. But yeah, no, that's a good question. So we didn't to get the full result, we wanted to use supersymmetry so that it was giving everything on the nose. But in that one, you can do it with twisted masses. Yeah. The only thing that I wanted to mention is not quite.
But it's overshooting because you don't need both sphere and twisted masses. Why do you need to make your life, you know, more torturous than it is?
He means to compute the partition function. You can introduce masses, but then what?
It's function of masses, what the problem?
Yeah.
Which observable?
The partition function. Yeah.
Because here it's considered as a function of lambda radio.
Yeah.
Instead of this would be lambda divided by mass.
Yeah, exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah, so it's not a big difference.
No, but you need to compute the partition function of R2. You need to either put it in omega background or
no way. Forget about omega background, we're talking just minimal one instant sector.
But which observable?
The partition function? Maybe the partition function is a function of the twist of lambda
divided by. Yeah, no, that's a good point, but.
And maybe radius of instanton will enter, because if it's not localized instanton.
No, but if it's a convergent of all other, it doesn't matter, right?
Yeah. It has a modulus.
You do get like instanton like configurations from the. Yeah.
I have a question, sorry. Oh.
No, I want to ask how important for your consideration is this 2,2 supersymmetry. If say, because you deform it anyway, if you say take 0,2.
Good. I don't know if people computed from supersymmetric localization that one. My guess would be no. You needed the full 2,2.
No, but Einstein to repeat the same question that if you would consider this radius of sphere to be small, then why you need localization?
Oh, because I get the full corrections, like all the perturbative and non-perturbative for multi-instantons. It's an exact result. I know, like in principle, you get the exact result and you claim victory and you don't do anything. But then, in this way, we actually reinterpret why this exact result was giving you this truncation. But yeah, no, of course you don't need it, but yeah, you get the full.
No, but okay, I agree. If you want to do it that way, take both this field
and the twisted masses.
The twisted mass, and then take your exact
absolutely
and look what is the answer. How the
he has the answer to that.
Okay, what is the answer?
In terms of microscopic configuration, I can tell you. We haven't worked.
But he's asking particularly what happened with this divergence in this probe.
No, you don't see it in this way because you have an IR cutoff.
Okay, so we have log R.
It is hidden in the Fayet-Leopoulos. Do you remember the Fayet-Leopoulos was running, right?
Yes.
It's the renormalized one that you have. That's the only one.
Log there.
So you get this log R, R being the radius of the sphere. That's the only.
But it's a different running. It's the running of the coupling.
Yeah.
And here you have the running just of the action and the leading, I mean, classical action.
No, it doesn't appear there,
Classical action diverges. Substitute the instanton solution.
Yeah.
Ah, maybe you change somehow the instanton solution is changed.
Because you're on the two sphere, not on R2.
But on the sphere it changes just by multiplying.
But on the sphere the action would be convergent because the radius of the sphere.
Of course.
So it would be convergent.
No, you're changing solution by adding the metric somewhere in the solution the metric of the sphere. It's the same solution but supplemented by metric.
Yeah.
But the mass term acts differently. At least the mass acts differently. It's a potential. It's not.
Yeah. But we actually check, so if you take the two-sphere partition function with the twisted masses, you can actually check that they reproduce the correct holonomies if you start running around in the twisted masses case.
I see.
Which, of course, is not the full story, but at least, you know, reproduce the non-result, the Cyber-Witten curve, if you want.
Just to see the simple question.
Oh, no, absolutely, yeah.
Happens, I mean, if you put the full answer.
Yeah.
To see what happens just with one instance.
Yes. Yeah, you had some.
So this thing that you're actually inserting, like in the localized theory. So
Is that like a specific type of operator?
Oh, yeah, we don't know. You can write it...
Like, I could start with anything else. I mean, you know...
Oh, excellent. So, good. So, in principle, you can actually consider whatever observable you want. You're just going to get out the cohomology classes of that observable.
Oh,
as soon as, yeah, so you can put that. And you see, the thing is that this observable looks very weird. I can write it in terms of the microscopic fields localized. They're just like sigma to the sigma, if you want, which is a weird observable to begin with. Yeah. Yeah, okay. Okay, can I just make one final comment? So, oh, we switch to the Russian now. I'm going to make one final comment, is that actually you can find something very similar, even if you consider something else, which I don't have an analog in quantum mechanics. So if you consider the CP R minus 1, where now R is a complex number or a real number, and you just repeat exactly the same story, you do generate perturbative coefficients that go like this, sine pi R gamma of n plus 1 minus R. And you see that for the CP R minus 1, analytically continued, the story is exactly identical. So R plays the role of delta, and whenever R goes to an integer, you get these truncations. However, from here, we don't see any, you see R, you can either send it to an integer, and then it truncates to the CPN partition function, or we don't see these quasi-exactly solvable observables over there. But it looks like, you know, whatever deformation you do, either in delta or in R, adding this cancellation that gives rise to convergent series is very, very special, of course.
Just a quick question. So when you do this, do you still see the non-perturbative?
Absolutely, yeah. Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
Good. Thank you.